Game on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green. I'm sure she's off home for her pancakes. It's Tuesday, the 16th of February, and this is Game On.
And to watch Liverpool, it sounds like, as well. Coming up today, Padraig Harrington on keeping his golf game in check while in COVID isolation.
No, I just use golf balls, actually. I don't have weighted balls with me. Sometimes I do. I actually threw it into the duvet so there's no sound. I've done this for many years and I'm well aware of upsetting my neighbours, and I make sure I don't make too much sound anyway.
Good man, Padraig. Mark Langdon is with us as the Champions League returns. Can Barcelona and PSG match this drama again?
It's Neymar trying to feed it through. It's a stretch and it's in. And I can't remember the last time I saw something like this. Extraordinary scenes at the Nou Camp. Sergio Roberto, the substitute, is the hero of the hour. And it is the greatest Champions League knockout comeback of all time.
Pure entertainment, but we'll have Damien Nodder tell us how the GAA have lost 34 million. And jockey Nico de Bonneville ahead of a Cheltenham full of promise.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can do so by texting us on 51552 or tweet at Game On 2FM. Now, as Ruby just mentioned, the GAA has announced losses of 34.1 million for 2020. The financial impact of lockdown on the association has been revealed with the release of their annual statements ending on the 31st of October last. For more on this, we are joined by RTE GAA reporter Damien Lawler. Damien, huge losses, but not entirely unexpected, really, just given the global pandemic that we are in.
Absolutely, Marie. These are well flagged. I mean, they were flagged nearly 6 months ago, to be honest with you. We thought it would be in the region of 31 million, and it was 34. So it's not a million miles off. It's a seismic effect in terms of the GAA in one way, in that in 2019, Central Council figures were kind of 73 million was coming into the GAA, revenue was coming in, and in 2020 that was way down to 31 million. And if you look at a kind of Croke Park figures, even 47 million they contributed like in 2019, and that was down to about 7.4 last year, or even lower. So it's like it's hard to get your head around it. But as you say, a global pandemic, gate receipts down, lack of supporters, lack of commercial income, ticket sales, only for the government's kind of input here, which is crucial, it will be extremely damaging. And I think that should the association, like all the other sporting organisations, by the way, should they have another year like this, well then it's really dangerous. So I was chatting to John Horan last week, and there is hope that the GAA will receive government funding this year. How much that will be, we're not so sure. And they got tallies of 15 million and 9 million on separate occasions last year. Don't think it'll be anything like that this time around, but I think it's going to be badly needed as well.
Damien, I think the reality is that we probably are going to have a year not too dissimilar to last year's, which is quite worrying. But when you think of the way the GAA is structured and how a lot of their funds and finances are filtered down through to the clubs and the counties around, what's going to be prioritised? Because not everything can be, not everyone can be.
No, well, I mean, infrastructure projects are definitely on the back burner now. And I would feel sorry for anybody who's in for kind of a stadium redevelopment or a centre of excellence, or handball alleys or astro parks or floodlit pitches. I'm not saying that they won't get them, but I'd say it'll be on the back burner by a fair degree. I think that, I suppose, protecting GAA staff around the country is a priority as well, Marie. And I think that they're in every corner of Ireland and trying to promote the game. So that's probably going to be something that you have to hope will happen too. I think really, though, there is some kind of spin-offs coming out of this that are not entirely negative too. And while it's a bleak picture out there, I feel that they've got their team expenditure under control now, or at least they have a template for doing it, because that had spiraled out of control completely. Like, counties are spending over a million on their county teams, which is unsustainable, really, unless you're one of the big four. And even at that, they've got to go separately fundraising with supporters clubs and that. So I think that Tom Ryan was talking today. There's a new addition to the GAA team, and she's going to go around like a kind of a safety and audit kind of inspector almost, to make sure that every county's governance is top class and that they're not spending any more than they need to. So I think a lot of the forward template is going to be central minded, in that there'll be no more kind of solo runs with counties spending above and beyond. It's going to be a lot more tight now and a lot more accountability needed as well. So I'd say, to answer your question, all the infrastructure projects going to be paused. I'd say existing loans hopefully pushed out or put on pause for as long as they possibly can, protect jobs, and then look after governance a bit tighter as well.
Damien, with your own experience of how county panels or county panels are run, can you see what Tom Ryan is suggesting actually coming through? Squads being limited to 32 players, 3 backroom staff, 3 sessions a week, etc. Yeah. All the things they brought in. Can you, when COVID goes, can you see the GAA being able to implement that?
Governance is a problem, Ruby. There's no point in saying otherwise. Not everywhere, but usually when it comes to team preparation and stuff like that, any rules that have been formed have traditionally been broken by a certain number of counties indifferently or randomly over the years. The only way that this can be enforced to any degree of success is by funding. In that, if your county board is only getting funding for 3 nights a week and is only getting player expenses for 32 players, well, that forces the issue then, a little bit. I'm not saying that managers won't go off and do solo runs, but with the split season coming in very, very soon, hopefully the cult of the inter-county manager, who probably wants to be out training 5 nights a week, that I think will have to be looked at again. To answer your question, it's going to be very difficult, but I think if they do it centrally, Ruby, you can make a start at it. But up to now, every county has been their own republic. You hear the training across the road 5 nights a week. Unfortunately, you're going to be at that as well. But I think what you're going to have this year, players are going to have to be given a proper chance to get a pre-season in. If players are rushed or overtrained, I think that injuries are going to be sustained. I also think that the GPA have kind of locked horns with the GAA on player charters over the year. But if you agree a certain amount for mileage, and if you agree a certain amount in panels, county boards won't pay this anymore because they simply don't have the money. So we could be reaching an interesting point in the juncture here, Ruby, but it won't be straightforward. The only way you can police it is by dollars and by euros, and not letting the money come through for more than those agreed sessions per week.
Unfortunately, Damien, history doesn't really tell us that's the way it works. So when you think of hearing teams running up hills in the 90s or going to do double sessions or going on to the beach, as soon as somebody starts to do something, then everybody kind of follows. So that's the way that it always
works. If the training session isn't covered by insurance, that's one way of stopping it straight away. It really, really is. Like, if you're running up a hill and you're building up your stamina running up and you're strengthening your muscles going up.
Or if
you're
on a beach, Damien, down in Southern County, Logan, sticks the logs around.
All these training sessions have to be sanctioned now. So, whatever's going to come centrally out of this, you'd imagine the insurance and the expenses are going to be central to it. So there's going to be... I'm not saying that counties won't break it, guys. I'm just saying that, there has to be a new dawn in all this now. Counties were overspending, and I think they were overtraining as well. The season was way too long. So now with the fifth season, they're trying to alleviate that stress and that problem on it.
Damien, you made a point there about a proper pre-season as well. This time last year, when none of us knew what was happening, and we were asking strength and conditioning coaches how long would it take to get players up to speed or whatever. And when you look at the GAA insurance payouts of 7.8 million this year, it's just below the average of 8 million for a truncated season. It probably means more injuries.
Oh, that's definitely the case. I mean, I would say that players were trying to get back in as peak condition as possible. And by some of the displays in the championship you saw last year, you wouldn't have thought that there was any upset to the routine. To be fair to players, the level of performance was incredible for some counties more than others. At the same time, it's a huge amount to have paid, as you say, for a truncated season. And I would imagine that the reason is players were kind of overloading, or they were a little bit panicked, or they were rushing it. And certainly the GPA will probably look for a 5-6 week pre-season. I think they'll come down on the side of a 4. That's if we can get going with a 5-week national league anytime in the next couple of months. But I think like that's where your backroom team and your S&C guys are going to have to be really on their game. But if you're reading between the lines, I think inter-county players have been training since Christmas, just waiting for the return to play. And I think they probably need to wind that down a little bit now and then perk it up again. So there's a science behind all of that that need to be carefully monitored.
Damien, how realistic do you think it is that there is going to be a national league? We heard Tom Ryan saying that they're in danger of not being played and it's too soon to reveal the association's fallback plans.
Yeah.
When do you think they are going to reveal them, and can you see a league being played?
Yeah, okay, if there's one competition to go, it'll be the Alliance League. I think that, there's definitely two trains of thought within the Croke Park board, I say, at this stage. And one is certainly pushing for club to go before county, and the other would be looking to get kind of all the games played, all the fixtures played. And I would say that would look like a 5-week national league. Back to the clubs then for a few months and then finish off with the inter-county championship like we had last year. The thing about getting crowds back in, crowds were allowed back in last September, and just looking back on it earlier today, the COVID daily figures were about 190 at that stage. We're well above all that now. So in terms of any crowds coming back, and that was just for a crowd of 200 in a 5,000-seater stadium. I do believe the GAA want to play the league. I do believe there's a huge appetite for games to come back. I would say the next landmark, Marie, will be next week when the government announces the new Living with COVID plan. And then if you give it a week or 10 days, the GAA will see what's available and what's possible. I'd be expecting maybe the restrictions to change next week with the government. GAA will adopt to that then, and maybe 10 days to 2 weeks later, they'll put dates on it. So it still can be done. It's obviously a very, very tight time frame. And you couldn't say for definite that the league will go ahead, but I know they do want the games to go ahead. And speaking to the president last week, he was confident enough, even though they lost the elite status, that all the games could be played. And I think the one thing that's bugging them is the unplayed games from 2020 at club level. They're really, really sore over that. They're upset that those games weren't played off for a number of reasons.
Are they going to play them off, Damien, do you think, when we get back, or will that be the end of it?
I think there's 11 county finals to be played, and I know that from talking to officials personally, it's actually weighing very heavily on their mind. And bear in mind that those county championships had to be cut short when a number of counties, the celebrations spilled over and the GAA didn't feel it was responsible to continue on with it. I think it could be December of 2021 by the time those county championships are replayed. And let's be honest about it, it leads to a logistical mess, and it's not pleasant. It wouldn't be pleasant for anybody to come back, but the other side of it too is, in 11 out of those 11 county finals, three counties nearly had three lockdowns, like the likes of Leash and Kildare, and somebody else had a prolonged 3-week lockdown on top of what the rest of us had.
That feels like a lifetime ago, doesn't it?
They put
Kildare down.
Yeah, it does.
And I remember living in Kildare. We haven't forgotten about it.
Well, I remember talking to you guys the night it happened, and I was literally wondering, like, because I live in Kildare, and I was literally wondering how you're going to pass the next few weeks, because you're back to the 5K limit again, and that cost Kildare, and Leash were hit badly as well, and I think Offaly were the other county involved, so that didn't help matters either. Look, everything is up in the air, rightly. I think people know that 2020 was a desperate financial year for the GAA. There are fears that 2021 will be equally as bad. Nobody knows if it'll get crowds in at all. But what worked was flexibility. An ability to adapt to whatever came at them. The streaming work, that actually brought in money for county boards and allowed them to get on with their business and pay bills. Looking at loans and putting pause on them, and having a kind of cooperation from banks and stakeholders, that helped as well. So I think this year is just there to be got through, really, in terms of playing games. But have you guys all noticed the clamour for underage children? Ruby, we had a discussion about this when I spoke to you last. And you mentioned about the levels of activity in the community, but everywhere you look, there's people lobbying now for kids' teams to get back. Not immediately, but certainly within the next 2 months, I think.
And Damien, just before we let you go, the GAA are running a deficit of 34 million. But what does that mean to ordinary members of the GAA? What does it mean for me, a member of St. Lawrence's GAA club? What effect is that going to have on just normal, ordinary members down at the very bottom of the food chain?
Okay, so like maybe this is just speaking hypothetically, but maybe improvements to the Larry's ground or clubhouse may not go ahead. Maybe the cost of membership over the next year or two could go up by a few bob. Maybe you might have to pay kind of a subsidy or a levy, but I think the GAA tried to provide games. Obviously, money is a massive part of it, but their principal business is providing games for members. And that won't change. You're having more teams and more games than ever before. I would feel, to be blunt about it, if you got a few All-Ireland Final replays, if they were still allowed in time, you could turn over €3 million for each of those. So I think the referees could be under pressure
now on the refs when they do come round.
Yeah, so I think, to be honest about it, it's obviously horrendous. But the GAA was in an unbelievable shape up to COVID financially. And if you could get back at it soon enough, normality, they wouldn't be long picking it up either, Ruby. I think the biggest thing would be big projects would be paused and bank loans would be pushed out.
I'd say everyone will they'll be going mad with the club lotto, Damien. Thanks so much
Ruby
for
calling bingo.
Yeah, thanks, Damien. We'll talk to you soon.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Fern's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value, and convenience stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So tonight sees the resumption of the Champions League knockout stages in the round of 16, and we're glad to have Mark Langdon on the line before Barcelona take on PSG and RB Leipzig face Liverpool. Mark, I suppose all eyes are pretty much going to be on Liverpool and Leipzig in this neck of the woods anyway.
Yeah, absolutely, Ruby. It's going to be a real test, isn't it, for Liverpool after their recent sort of shambles, really, of results in the Premier League. I actually felt like they played okay against Leicester for a large part of that game on Saturday, but same old problems, really, defensively, eventually cost them. Leipzig, a dangerous team. They reached the semi-finals of the Champions League last season. They knocked out Atletico Madrid. They're second in the Bundesliga this time around. I think they're a different team to what they were sort of 12 months ago. They lost their star player, Timo Werner, and Julian Nagelsmann, that their coach, was adamant at the time that they didn't really have the funds to be able to play somebody as good as Werner and sort of just buy a like-for-like replacement. So they have changed the way that they play. I think they're a sort of better defensive team now, maybe don't need as many goals. In saying that, of course, they were involved in two absolutely chaotic games against Manchester United already this season in the group stage. But that was not really been the norm of much of their season. I was staggered when they were thrashed at Old Trafford and then that sort of kamikaze game against United at home where they nearly threw away the free goal advantage. Like I say, that's not really been their style of play for much of their season. Mainly a controlled team that's dangerous on the counter-attack. So interesting to see whether the game kind of plays out like most of their matches have in the Bundesliga this season, or if they somehow get involved in like a basketball game again.
I think, Mark, a lot of Liverpool fans will be very happy to know that it's their right back, Angelino, who is their top scorer, that they don't really have that kind of out-and-out goal-getter since Werner left. But just with that in mind, who do you think Klopp should start? Should he go with Kabak again or show some faith in the likes of Phillips or Williams?
He is really not happy with Kabak. She's blaming Kabak. Him forever to happen.
He's gone.
Alisson.
I think I'd probably go for Kabak just because, I mean, he obviously knows the team he's up against. And also, I think Leicester, probably one of the it's not a nice debut to make when Vardy and Barnes are making those runs off of the kind of the opposition left flank in behind you for 90 minutes. And they're two of the best around at doing that. I still feel like this is somebody with more experience than the other two, who's, I'd say, the long-term better bet. I know he didn't have a great start against Leicester, but I think none of the options are that convincing, are they? One thing I'd like to see Liverpool do is be a little bit better defensively in midfield, and I felt that Thiago, for all of the qualities that he brings to Liverpool in terms of possession, he hasn't defended very well when he's been in the team, and I think Klopp places a big emphasis on you defend as a team, and it's not really about the individual, and the collective in terms of that defence has been wrong and has been for a little while, and I think for obvious reasons as well.
Mark, Leipzig are second in the Bundesliga. Liverpool are only fourth in the Premier League. Yeah, Liverpool are 8-1 to win the Champions League. Leipzig are 40-1 to win it. Liverpool are 4-9 to win this tie, and Leipzig are 13-8. Are Leipzig being given the respect they should be getting?
They're probably not getting the respect that they deserve. I think it's maybe down a little bit to what happened against Manchester United when they were absolutely torn apart at Old Trafford and nearly threw away the game at home against them. The Bundesliga isn't as strong as the Premier League. It's a strong league, but if you have a look at, say, the Premier League with sort of Tottenham and Arsenal down in mid-table, I feel like they'd be higher up in the Bundesliga if they were, you know, playing at that level. So I think that it's probably, if you're fourth in the Premier League, you're probably still sort of maybe better than the second best team in the Bundesliga. Although I'd completely take the point that Leipzig are probably being slightly underrated. I mean, they're still new team, that they're still not, they haven't really won sort of much as a side, you know, so that they have got to that sort of aspect to prove as well. And as Marie was just saying there, you know, Angelino, who couldn't get a game for love nor money at Manchester City, is the top scorer for them, you know, and that's from a left back or left wing back position. So they haven't got much of a goal for it, I don't think, now. But it's about the team as a collective, and Nagelsmann as a coach, I'm not sure he'll leave Leipzig for a while yet, but when he does, it'll almost certainly be for one of, you know, the absolute giants of European football, if that's a Bayern Munich or a Real Madrid or somebody like that.
Mark, speaking of absolute giants of European football, Barcelona, PSG, and with players like Neymar and Messi and Mbappe, and there's brilliant stats going around, but my favourite fun fact is that it is bringing together two former Southampton managers in Koeman and Pochettino.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Koeman's very fortunate to be the Barcelona manager. It's more to do with what he did there as a player, of course, scored the winning goal for them in a European Cup final, that one at Wembley against Sampdoria. So had the connection with the club, wasn't anything really on his CV to suggest he should have got that Barcelona job. For Pochettino, of course, he's got the connection with Paris Saint-Germain, but probably, even though he hadn't won a trophy, he'd probably done more at Southampton and then at Tottenham to kind of deserve to take that next step. But a really big game for both, because I think the jury's out on both coaches, because if Pochettino goes out at the last 16 of the Champions League, he's immediately on the back foot, because the Champions League is going to be everything to PSG. There's been slight sort of discontent among the fans about the style of play at the moment at Paris. They haven't been quite as offensive as what we've sort of come to expect of them, and you mentioned that those brilliant players that they've got in the team. Against Marseille, when they won there recently, it was all about the counter-attack, and I think some Paris Saint-Germain fans would like to see a more dominant performance from PSG in this game. But Barcelona are the team that fascinate me, because I've not spoken to anybody that thinks that Barcelona have got a reasonable chance of winning the Champions League, which is quite amazing, really, given they've still got Ter Stegen, Umtiti won the World Cup, Frenkie de Jong, Busquets, you've got Messi, Griezmann, Ousmane Dembele, Coutinho only on the bench. This is a team that has got talented players, but nobody fancies them to win the Champions League. I don't fancy them myself, but do just wonder whether, you know, they could be the forgotten team of the whole competition. They've got a fair chance tonight, because Neymar and Di Maria are out for Paris Saint-Germain, so it's not a full strength PSG, that's for sure.
But as well as having Neymar missing and Di Maria, they haven't really replaced Thiago Silva in defence either, PSG, and they're a fraction weak at the back.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Thiago Silva at Chelsea, we've seen what he brings to the team. He does lack a bit of pace now, but his organisational skills and leadership skills, I still think, are being missed there. And one of the reasons that Thomas Tuchel fell out with the Paris Saint-Germain board was over the decision not to buy a quality sort of top rank centre-back in the summer. He felt like they needed one. I think Marquinhos is one of those sort of top players, but Kimpembe alongside him, I think he does make mistakes. So and the left back Kozawa is another one that he likes to get forward, but I think he leaves sort of space in behind. So that Paris Saint-Germain defence, it doesn't get tested very often because of their sort of domestic dominance. So it's only in games like this where we get to see whether they're good enough. And often it's sort of too late. And then but by the time they realise they're not good enough, they're out of the Champions League. So a really big game. I think that's maybe why Pochettino's been a bit more defensive, because he maybe doesn't trust that defence enough. So he wants to sort of put an extra man in midfield. And Verratti, who used to be kind of a deep line playmaker, now plays much further up the pitch as a number 10, and they can get Idrissa Gueye into the midfield there. So I suspect that Pochettino thinks the same about that PSG defence as yourself, Ruby, in that it needs that little bit of extra protection in midfield.
Mark, when you think about all the fanfare and the excitement when Pochettino was linked with the club and then his unveiling and announcement and everything that came with that, but if you fast forward to now, do you think he's improved the team from what he took over?
No, I don't think he has yet. And I think it's always going to be difficult to do that in a sort of pandemic season when everybody is playing, even in France, they haven't got quite as many cup competitions as in, say, the Premier League. But when you're playing Saturday, Wednesday, you know, Saturday, Tuesday, there's no time on the training field whatsoever for any of these coaches. So I think you won't see kind of his true philosophy on the team until next season. And sort of, you know, when he's had a whole summer to work with them. And by the time that happens, you know, if things haven't gone well in the Champions League, then he's on the back foot and you are under immediate pressure. But that's just the way it is in this season. I know that Tuchel's come in at Chelsea and done a reasonable job. I would say that I don't think he's beaten that much yet. And so maybe we should judge him on sort of the tougher tests to come. And I think for Pochettino, You just haven't got that time to work with the players, and then Di Maria and Neymar get injured, which immediately throws some of his plans out of the window anyway. So he's won a trophy already. He won the French Super Cup, but it's not yet sort of a true Pochettino team.
I think Pochettino will be looking to kind of bump into Messi there some stage this evening in the tunnel and see if he wants to come to PSG next year.
This is the real subplot, really, of this tie. I think Paris Saint-Germain, they've made it pretty obvious that they can afford Lionel Messi and that they quite like Messi to play for them next season in what would be the kind of ultimate dream team up front, with Neymar on the left, Messi on the right, and Mbappe through the middle. Yes, I think that there will be a definite kind of, you know, if Messi has a good game, he'll be probably linked with PSG. If he has a bad game, people will say that he was affected by, you know, people already linking him with Paris Saint-Germain. But this is a subplot to the game, and definitely there are people at Barcelona who are very unhappy with the way that PSG are maybe making their advances known towards Lionel Messi. But come on, this is Barcelona. They've done it to enough players themselves in the past.
I wouldn't mind at all. Messi saga to get us through the next lockdown, the next whatever's coming in the next few months. Mark Langdon, thanks so much. And just as well to remind everybody that Liverpool-Leipzig match is on RTE2 with coverage from 7:30 p.m.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Green Fern's new on-the-go chicken bites are natural, high in protein and packed with flavour.
On 2FM. Welcome back. Today marks Padraig Harrington's eighth day of isolation, and the three-time major champion admits while he is happy with the precautions he took, he is unsure over the longer-term impact of a positive COVID-19 test. Greg Allen has been catching up with him about his time in COVID isolation.
Game on. Go.
I seem to be fine. Obviously, with COVID, you can't be quite sure about the long-term effects, but you know, from so far, it's been, I suppose, a mild flu, a bad cold, something like that. Certainly, after I had a high viral load, so I tested negative last Saturday week, and then to get on the charter to fly here, and then I was positive on the Monday. I had a high viral load on the Monday, so they did expect symptoms, and I did have symptoms on Tuesday. I wouldn't have known I was sick. I would have, even when I got the symptoms, I probably, you know, if this was a different year, I'd have thought this is a, you know, I would have pushed through it, would have taken a few paracetamol on it and tried to push through it. I probably, the sensible thing would have been taking to my bed for 24 hours with some paracetamol. But obviously, with COVID around and the positive test, it was quarantine in the room for 10 days. And it went okay. You know, I did have, as I said, those small symptoms. I worried more than anything else when you have some symptoms, every little thing. I wonder, is it this or that? And they cleared up by the weekend, and I'm kind of fine, even though I have a little bit of a nasal drip again. I don't know what that really means, but I feel fine. And I started back doing a little bit of practice in my room today, pushing myself a little bit. I took it really easy for the last 7 days. So today I did a little bit of swinging in the room with an impact bag and some throwing and things like that, just to push myself. And yes, I did need to go to bed straight away afterwards. I was tired.
I'd say the people in the room beside you love that. The impact bag, I presume, were the pillows. and the whatever weighted ball you threw was against the wall.
No, I just use golf balls, actually. I don't have weighted balls with me. Sometimes I do. I actually threw it into the duvet, so there's no sound. It's okay. I've done this for many years, and I'm well aware of upsetting my neighbours. So I make sure I wouldn't do it. I do it during the day when obviously everybody should be awake, and I make sure I don't make too much sound anyway.
And there is this tournament in Los Angeles, the Genesis Invitational, which you really want to play in. I know it's Riviera, is one of the great golf courses on the American PGA Tour Rota, and that starts Thursday. And you think you have a chance of playing?
I'm entered, I expect the PGA Tour to get an afternoon tea time, so I can travel up on Thursday and play. I do expect to play, and I expect to be ready to play, but I'm not quite sure how. You know, this is why I'm swinging at the moment. I want to know that, you know, halfway through the round, I don't get, you know, fatigue and have to stop or something like that. But I feel good. I feel like I'm ready to play. And to be honest, you know, it's not like I can do much else. You know, when you've got this, I mightn't get a negative test for a while to be able to travel back to Ireland even. So, you know, I might as well go out and play golf even if I'm not 100% prepared.
How have you dealt with this in your head? Because I know that we've spoken quite a bit over the last 8 months, and I know how fastidiously careful you were in avoiding getting the virus. And obviously you're in America, you're on planes, you're in airports, and you get the virus. But I know how careful you were.
Yeah, I was pretty diligent about it all. I think, you know, I would have taken the early on in COVID, I would have taken the initial steps of being exceptionally cautious, because nobody really knew what we're dealing with. I'm not saying that everybody knows now for sure, but certainly there was more clarity. And when I did start back playing, I was comfortable with the risk I was taking. You know, you obviously hope you don't get this, I'm trying to think. You know, you kind of second guess yourself. You know, certainly having been out in Europe and then coming to the States, it's a little freer in the States, but I'm not 100% sure where I picked it up. And as we know about this with a lot of things, like I spent a lot of time with my caddy Ronan, and he didn't get it, so it's quite. Where I picked it up, we're not sure, and how I picked it up, and just, you know, some people get it and some people don't in some circumstances like that. And you know, I'm at the moment not second guess. I did second guess myself, but I'm not at the moment worrying too much about it. I'm just, it is what it is, and I've taken all the precautions beforehand. I've done all the stuff I can at the moment, and I will continue to try and make sure I don't get any residual long-term effects from long COVID.
So within the States, I mean, we're talking about possibly teeing it up in a big PGA Tour event on Thursday. What do you have to do in terms of testing wise to be able to do that?
I'm fully clear after 10 days under CDC. So 10 days after you test, you are clear to go in the States. Once you have a positive test, the date and time of that, 10 days later, you are free for 90 days. I think it's 90 days without being subject to the testing protocols, because of the fact that you're just going to keep testing. The likelihood is you're going to test positive for quite a while after it's gone.
So effectively, the 10 days between testing positive and your tee-off time in the Genesis Invitational is a matter of hours, isn't it?
It would be, yeah, it's Thursday morning would be my 10-day time. So if I did have a morning tee time, I wouldn't be able to play. In the afternoon, I can't play, yes.
So all you really have to know now is, do you feel you can play? Is that it? It's up to you?
It's purely up to me, yes. And I do feel like I can play. I feel like I'm you know, the only issue with playing is a golfing issue, as in, you know, 10 days without hitting a golf shot and you know, but I feel in that sense I've nothing to lose in terms of playing golf, that, you know, I shouldn't forget how to play golf after 10 days. So hopefully it will still be there. There is complications to obviously not having played for 10 days. But the last tournament I played without a practice round was the Open in 2008. And that worked out kind of well for me.
I was just going to say, can you imagine if you shot 65 in the first round in Riviera? That'll throw 30 years of habit out the window. You'll just do nothing for the next tournament.
Yes, if only it worked like that. It was only if it was as simple as what you did last week was proof perfect of what you should do every week.
So what have you been doing? You've been quarantined in a room for 7 days now. And, you know, you're not... Well, I think you're a pretty patient person, but... presume it's been challenging.
No, not really. No, I went to there was different emotions. I did 2 days solid of Netflix and just, you know, binged on that, and then I really got bored of that. And then the next day was funny. Somebody sent me a WhatsApp of some 80s nostalgia, and it just set off a wave. And I spent, I nearly did 24 hours of 80s pop music and 80s TV sitcoms and all sorts of things like that, which really cheered me up actually at that stage. If I was feeling down, it just was a nice thing. And now I'm kind of now in that phase of, I'm watching a bit of stuff on TV, and I watch the golf. I'm starting to do a bit of swinging, a few exercises in the room, a bit of stretching, starting to get my head around, you know, preparing for Thursday.
You missed the cut in Phoenix, first cut you've missed in 8 tournaments. So I did a bit of digging through the old statistics, and I think it's the best run of cuts made since 2012. And you've had a few top tens in there, and a 6th place in Dubai. What's happening, Padraig? You're playing really nicely again.
I started putting better. That helped. You know, I definitely started putting better through those weeks. Once you start putting better, it takes some pressure off the rest of your game. And you know, I haven't hit my irons well in that period, and I haven't, you know, so I wouldn't be, I don't feel like, oh, well, I played great or anything like that, but I put it better and I've driven the ball well. It's pretty easy to play golf when you drive the ball well. So those two sides of my game have been quite good. And outside of that, I kind of, and I don't feel like I've really got a proper run in this, but I've been looking to get really good focused on playing, not so much on anything else, and trying to get a run of playing and get my routines right. And that's that sort of way on the golf course. Just, and I do hope that will bring my iron play back.
Game on. Go. With Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm on-the-go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. You can hear the full interview between Greg Allen and Padraig Harrington on the Game On podcast, wherever you get your usual podcasts, is the line Dunica gives out. So I assume that still counts. I believe Dunica is.
Absolutely. That's best place for him, Ruby.
Yeah, I'm big up in those podcasts, me. But anyway, moving on, I'm delighted to say we've been joined this evening by Nico de Boinville and Nicky Henderson, stable jockey, in our build up towards Cheltenham. Nico, how are you?
Very well. How are you this evening?
We're great, thank God, Nico. We're great. Nico, just before we delve into the future in Cheltenham, I've always wondered, how does a guy who won an open scholarship to Bradfield College, went to university in Newcastle to study history and politics, end up as a jockey?
You've done your research, Ruby. I'm a bit embarrassed about it. I don't know, it's just the allure of horses, isn't it? I've always been into horses all my life, and you know yourself, they're very hard to stay away from.
They are. I know your mum, your late mum, actually was a dressage rider. But how do you get from equestrian to horse to race horses?
It was slowly but surely. My aunt and uncle train a few flat horses, and they've had a bit of success over the years. And I've had it on my doorstep, but it was never something that I really dreamed could be possible until I went over to work for Richard Gibson in France, in Chantilly. And he was a hard taskmaster, and he really gave me the bug and, you know, let me know that I could achieve my ambitions and my dreams.
So when you're in Newcastle then, maybe studying to be the next Boris Johnson, whoever it is you wanted to be, how did you up sticks and go to Seven Barrows to work for Nicky Henderson? Where was the connection there?
Well, there was a good bit of drinking involved up in Newcastle, and I probably wasn't in the best place. But then it was actually Peter Hobbs said, look, you've got to go to the best available, and then it's sink or swim. So you've got to jump into the fire and see if you can survive it. And so there I went and started off as a stable lad and under Corky Brown, and away we went.
What was the hardest part about it? You know, sink, swim, survival. What do you need to do? Like, what's the thing that you look back on and say, I can't believe I got over that?
You've just got to be resilient, I suppose, and just keep at it. Work very, very hard. Keep your eyes open, your mouth shut. Watch and learn. I was very lucky that I had some unbelievable jockeys, you know, in and out of there with Barry Geraghty, AP McCoy, Andrew Tinkler, and among others. You know, competition was so hot back then. And it was, you know, there was so much to learn from. And if you didn't learn, then, you know, you must have been mad. And it took me a bit of time for myself to get it all figured out, but eventually, you make small strides, and then they turn into big strides.
I'm not from a racing background at all, so I'm not familiar with the way the environments and the industries work. But when you're in a situation where there's a huge amount of competition, and you're trying to learn and find your feet and to blaze a path, really, do the other jockeys, do they give you advice? Do they want to help you? Do they bring you along? Does it work like that?
It is a very dog-eat-dog environment, but at the same time, you know, the elder jocks who have got a firm footing in the game, they're more than happy to help you out, particularly retired jockeys as well. You know, there are always people there to listen to you, and you can always ask advice. I mean, I've had an awful lot of help from a lot of established jockeys, and they've helped me a lot along the way. But ultimately, it's down to yourself, and you've got to look at yourself and be honest with yourself, and if things aren't working, then you've got to do something about it. There's a bit of self-reflection and honesty involved as well.
Nico, when you started in Seven Barrows, you started riding, I suppose, at the time no one knew what he was, but it was Sprint de Sacre. Did starting to ride him from his very early days help you with your career as a jockey?
Without a doubt. You know, it's always about getting on these good horses, because they teach you, they give you a good benchmark as to what's good and what's bad. And I guess I was riding Sprint de Sacre from the word go, so we probably didn't know how good he was until he reached his Supremes and his Arkles stages. But once you get there, you realize that you're riding the best of the best, and if that's the best, then, you know, you can work your way down and figure it all out that way.
Look, you've had a pretty short career as a professional. You started as an amateur, but you've managed to ride at a 20% strike rate for the last 7 years. You've formed a great relationship with Nicky Henderson, and this year is no different. Obviously, last weekend was disappointing with Newbury being called off, but it's going to be on this week. I mean, touching some of those horses, and the one that interests me most is Champ. I mean, Nicky's going to drop him back to 2 miles at the weekend. It'll be your first time to ride him in public. Are you excited about it? Nervous about it? Have you spoken to Barry? What way are you approaching it?
Of course. It's a bit of a different... It's coming from left field slightly, and I don't think anyone expected Nicky to go and do that to drop him back to 2 miles, but we've got to get a run into him before, you know, even attempting a Gold Cup, I think. But of course I'm excited. I'll definitely be having a word with Barry and talking about it, but ultimately you've got to go, you're on your own out there, and you've got to go and do it yourself. I've done an awful lot of schooling on the horse, so we shall see, but I'm very much looking forward to it, and aren't we lucky that Ruby rescheduled the meeting?
Yeah, very, very lucky, very un-Newbury-like. But, Nico, yeah, look, you've won a Gold Cup on Coney Gray. Does Champ remind you of that? Would you be happy to ride him over Santini?
We'll have to see. I mean, you know, I'm keeping all options open, as I know you would as well. And I'm not going to nail my colours to any mast just yet. But let's see what he can do on Sunday. And he's got all the right credentials. He's got course form, and Yeah, so let's see what you can do on Sunday.
One short price favourite you will ride is Shishkin in the Arkle. He obviously won the Supreme last year. You watched All Mankind winning yesterday. Energamine winning last weekend. Are you still happy you have the best horse in Shishkin?
I know every jockey says this, but I wouldn't change my lad for the world. I mean, what did you think of All Mankind, Ruby?
What did I think? I think I would want a parachute if I was riding All Mankind.
look, it's going to be a great race, isn't it? I think, you know, it's going to be great because people can envisage how the race is going to turn out, and All Mankind will set off at a blistering gallop, and Energamine and Shishkin will follow away, and hopefully they will serve up a proper clash. And, you know, despite not having any crowds there, you know, I'm hoping that we can entertain a few people on the telly.
I'm sure you will. After Shishkin, you might or probably be on Bouvard there in the Champion Hurdle. Look, he won it in 2017, he won it in 2018, fell in 19, missed 20. You rode him on his comeback run in Haydock. It looks on the book like he's a lot of improving to do. Can he make that jump back to Grade 1 level?
If there's any man to trust, it's Nicky Henderson in getting these older horses to, you know, vitalise and get a bit of spark back to them. He had an awful lot of time off, and I think, you know, the way you have to look at it is that he could have been retired after that freak accident in the Fighting Fifth. So anything's a bonus since then, and we were just delighted to get him back on the track and to see him run to some sort of form. He will come on for that run an awful amount, and he seems in good fettle at home.
Is it fair to say then if you're trusting Nicky to get Bouvard Air right back, you're going to have to trust him at Altior as well?
Exactly. We're very much on the same sort of page. He's missing his appointment this weekend, but, you know, he'll definitely do a good piece of work. He might have a race called Gallop, and then hopefully he's got a stab at getting the three-timer in the Champion Chase.
Were you in any way tempted to suggest to Nicky that maybe he should go a bit further now he's a bit older?
The talk was muted. I mean, I'm very lucky at this stage in my career. I've been with Nicky since 2009, so we can have fairly honest and open discussions about things. And I did just chuck in the ball out there that 2.5 miles might be a nice way to build his confidence up before having another go at the Champion Chase. But as it happened, things didn't work out like that. But look, I think let's go and have a go and let's have a crack and let's see what he can do.
We keep hearing so much about Altior's work at home and how fast he is, yet when I watch him on the track, he never seems to show that. Why do you think that is?
I think, you know, we're comparing him from when he was a bit younger. You know, when he was younger, you know, three years ago or so, he really would tear up the gallops, and he's not quite the same anymore. You know, he's a bit more laid back in his demeanour, and he's a bit more chilled out, and he's definitely getting that way on the track as well. So I'm hoping, you know, we can spark a bit of life back into him, and he can enjoy his race.
Another one you'll probably be riding in the Ryanair is Mr. Fisher. Do you think he's overpriced at the odds he's at the moment?
I think so. I mean, the ground will have to dry out. I mean, I live just a stone's throw from the racecourse, and it is very, very wet over here at the moment. And I think he'd be suited to better ground. But I was impressed with him in the Peterborough Chase. I think you probably highlighted to me where I went wrong with him in the Marsh last year. So I think we'll be positive on him and give it a good go.
It's always easy with hindsight, Nico. And Dan, well, the Campagna. And Dan, the Campagna, she was a faller last week, and she got brought down in the Scilly Isles last week. Could she revert back to hurdles maybe and go to the Mayor's Hurdles? She won the Coral Cup last season.
I don't know. I see she's in it. You talked to her on Sunday. But, you know, she is actually a good chaser, and she jumps the fence very well. I think it was just one of those things at Sandown. Things just didn't quite work out for us, and I was happy with her at Ayr. We'll see. I mean, there's plenty of water to go under the bridge first, and I think she's got a career over fences anyway.
And when you're looking at Cheltenham, look, you were leading rider there in 2019 with three winners. When you're looking at it in 2021, what kind of a festival can you envisage for yourself?
I think I'll be... It's looking a bit tricky. I mean, watching the Dublin Racing Festival the other weekend, it was scary, the amount of talent coming out of Willie's Yard, and obviously Gordon's got some great horses as well. So, you know, they're going to really serve it up to us. And I think it's going to be a tough year because nothing really stands out for us at the moment. But I'm hoping, you know, we could bag one or two.
Well, I'm going to wish you the best of luck, even though I'd be hoping many more horses do.
I know.
Thanks a million for taking our call, and the best of luck this weekend as well.
No problem. Thanks,
Thanks
really
so much.
Good to see you all. Thank you.
Cheers.
All right.
I'm going to move on, guys, if you don't mind, very quickly to, before we have to go, because Liverpool team news is in.
Oh,
and
yes.
It is as I feared, Quebec is starting.
Go on, Quebec.
So there's Alisson, Alexander-Arnold, Quebec, Henderson and Robertson, then Wijnaldum, Jones, Thiago, Mane, Salah and Firmino. So look,
you'll be hoping, Marie, he's a man of the match performance.
Well, I was really happy when I saw that it was Angelino, their wing back, who was their leading scorer. So you'd kind of hope he might get a little bit of time to settle in. And
are you nervous, Marie?
Pardon?
Are you nervous as the Liverpool fan this evening?
I'm just delighted that it's not the Premier League, that it's something different. Yeah. So I think it might be
so that you can give it the classic. It's been a poor year. We just won the Champions League.
Exactly.
What about rugby news?
Yeah, rugby news.
French coach Fabien Galthié tested positive for COVID-19.
Yeah, and I suppose, Ruby, I was one of the people that actually forgot COVID was going on with the Six Nations, you know, underway. The rugby quality was so good, but you forget these squads are travelling around Europe. And so he's in isolation. The whole French squad is. The RFU reported today that everyone had returned negative tests from the RFU, but it's just something to keep an eye on, that the protocols stay up to pace as well as they can. So we've provincial action this weekend, and 12 players have been left back to their provinces, so it's good for them to get game time, but we need tight bubbles.
Donnacha, can a player going back into provincial action this weekend play his way into the team?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be honest with you, Ruby, there's guys there that'll want it. You've been in too much friendly fire and you actually need a game yourself to probably just force the hand. Someone like Craig Casey, you know, coming back to Munster, you'd like to give him a bit of a lead, you know, to leave him go out there, because he's probably so frustrated, needs a bit of a game and needs match time. You can do all the training you want. You know better than anyone that, you know, you need games as well. So there's a lot of players going back. Bundiaki, Ulton, Delan, David Heffernan head back to Connacht. Ryan Beard, Ross Byrne, Jack Conan head back to Leinster, Craig Casey, Andrew Conway, Shane Daly and Chris Farrell to Munster, and Stuart McCluskey and Tom O'Toole back to Ulster. So there is good competition for places.
Okay, we never actually got to mention yesterday about Dan Levy. I think everybody will be super disappointed for him.
Absolutely gutted for the guy. Really am. I think a guy that we were all so excited about coming back, and just look, Ruby, you know better than anyone, picking up a bad injury after coming back from something he has. But look, whatever about him physically, he is mentally really tough, and hopefully he can keep going.
That's what it'll test, Donnacha. I remember coming back after breaking my leg, and it lasted 2 days in Cheltenham when I broke it again. And it is the people around him and the support network that he has and all his teammates that he's going to need, because it will not be the physical pain, it'll be what's between his ears that'll be hurting most.
No fear of him with it, though. You know, he's a super player and we need him back.
He really is. But Donnacha, like, this time of year, though, when the Six Nations, and there was talk about potentially him maybe being back in time, for it to try and deal with that.
And look, it's what happens, players. I've seen it myself with Gerry Flannery. It's what Ruby's saying. It's the mental toughness now to keep going. And Marie, the biggest thing is actually backing yourself, actually knowing that the quality is still there and you've still got it.